My name's Miles Irving. I've been foraging since I was a small kid, thanks to a very helpful right sort of grandfather who taught me a few mushrooms.
Is that in the countryside, in the towns?
Yeah, no, it was in rural Suffolk that I was introduced to foraging by my grandfather, yeah. And I sort of stumbled into foraging for a living about 20 years ago because I happened to mention that it was an interest in something I did at a local restaurant, and they asked me if I'd supply them, and that one thing led to another. I ended up supplying lots of restaurants. And from there, I started also teaching people. But we had a bit of publicity in the national press, and that meant that a publisher approached me, which is like a dream scenario. You know, everyone trying to get a book published, and I had a publisher say, "Would you write a book on foraging?" Which was just, I think it's, The title of the book is The Forager Handbook, and it's been out for a while now. It came out in 2009, but luckily, it's not going to go out of date.
Okay, so you're down here at the at Monkton Wild giving a course. Can you just take us through the sort of introduction to what foraging is really about and why it appeals to you particularly?
Well, I like to basically ground foraging as food that comes from here. So, every other species just gets what it needs from its immediate surroundings, right? So we as a species have become rather odd, and we get what we need from everywhere but our immediate surroundings. So whilst, of course, you can grow stuff and things like that, to me, foraging is a response to the wild ecosystem that is at your fingertips. Yeah.
I think, for example, I've travelled in France a bit, and people over there just do seem to know their surrounding countryside better and what can be... Is that, am I right?
Yeah, well, I think we are probably amongst the most disconnected people on Earth in the UK, and that's because we were the originators of the Industrial Revolution, and at around about the same time, the Enclosures Acts were taking rural people off land and therefore breaking their, generations, probably thousands of years old in some ways, relationship to land, culture, connections to plants, and, all of that got completely uprooted and people just hurled into cities to work in factories. And I don't think we haven't got over that. We're more impoverished when it comes to land-based culture, I think, than most countries. So, what we've got at the moment is a tremendous blessing of, like, refugees and we've had people from Eastern Europe coming here for the last, I don't really know, but for a while we've had, when we were in the EU, it meant that we had lots of people coming here that did have a land-based culture. So I think there's hope for us, if we...
I was travelling in Russia in 2015, and I can remember vividly driving, seeing a whole load of Russians coming out of the woods with big things of mushrooms. So they obviously, other parts of the world seem to do this better than we do, like you say.
It's still normal. And the thing that I've got onto lately is that this is actually a thing called biocultural heritage. And it turns out that people that have been thinking along those lines to call this biocultural heritage, it's actually the key to stopping the ecological collapse that we're all worried about. The places on Earth where people still have heritage that connects them to plants and other species in their landscape through actual practical uses, they're the ones that are looking after the land and stopping things going extinct. So, if you care about species diversity, don't send money to the World Wide Fund for Nature. Just start helping to recultivate the biocultural heritage in this country. In other words, get to know the plants and animals in your neighbourhood and do it with other people so that it's a collective affair. I mean, this is the thing that I've realised after all these years of, it's an individual pursuit, it's a bit of an obsession. I've realised that actually what foraging is for is getting people in a neighbourhood together to go out gathering and to start getting routines and habits that then become culture, that then become part of the actual fabric of a community, and actually, foster a community because we do these things together.
You can't do it really in the town if you're a townie, though, can you?
Yeah, sure you can. There's green spaces in most towns, and unfortunately, we've had sort of some unpleasant sort of fascist moves from councils who get this kind of conservation mindset, this sort of fortress conservation mindset that and they've started sort of banning people from picking this and that in the local park. It's a complete misconception because, of course, what's causing problems with wildlife and species diversity is basically habitat loss and development. The idea that people in a local park in Bristol foraging is going to cause, you know...
Well, can you forage in a local park in Bristol? Is there anything?
Yeah, there'd be nettles. I mean, the thing is, what happens when we stop managing everything to an obsessive degree is that the nettles and brambles move in. Fantastic, because, you know, nettles are an incredibly nutritious green vegetable. They're delicious. They're full of umami compounds. You can fry them up as crisps. You can use them as spinach. You can make a soup with mushrooms that's as meaty as any dashi stock. Brambles, obviously, what can I say? It speaks for itself. But I've just been talking to someone, and I haven't done this myself, that's been making a kind of thing that's a lot like black tea, just taking the young tips of the brambles and you kind of bruise them up a bit so they oxidize. Apparently it's a super delicious tea with lots of medicinal benefits. So I don't know, it's just to me like the wild ecology will start encroaching in a way that is actually beneficial the minute we just relax a little bit and stop being so control freakery about management and tidiness.
Have you got any special things you think are your favourites when you see a particular plant out in the countryside somewhere? Think that's, you know, something that is people don't know about, but actually is edible and it's really nice.
Yeah, I think people. So there's a plant called hogweed, which is one of my absolute favourites. I probably eat more hogweed than anything else, and obviously a lot of people think, oh no, giant hogweed. Which, if you get the juice on your skin, it's
isn't that like a cow parsley type?
It's in the same family as cow parsley. So, the cow parsley family, they all have flowers in the structure that looks a bit like an umbrella. So, they used to be called umbellifers. Yeah, and hogweed is a delicious green. You can use the stalks just like celery. You can use the stems just before they flower like asparagus. You can use the seeds as a spice. It's used all across the Middle East, but for some reason we don't know about it here. It tastes a bit like cardamom and coriander seeds combined. And hogweed, yeah, it's just delicious for salads, for greens, for crunchy stir fry. You can do it like a substitute for that crispy seaweed that isn't really seaweed from the Chinese shop. You fry it in oil till it's crispy and add a bit of salt, a bit of chili and lemon juice. Super delicious. And it's everywhere.
I mean, it might be a bit of a trade secret, but can I ask you about when you started doing work for restaurants? What kind of stuff were they after?
Oh, well, initially, there was just the obvious things like mushrooms and wild garlic, but, like, we kept bringing more and more things in, and most of what we brought has stuck. Funny thing is, anything with pig in the name doesn't seem to have stuck, so hogweed, never really taken off. There's another favourite of mine called sow thistle, that's never taken off. There's a little spicy mustard thing called swine cress. So we ought to, if we'd have been a bit more savvy, we'd have probably renamed all of those plants, made them sound more luxurious or, I don't know.
Now, I mean, you might know there's been this case recently in Australia of someone either mistakenly or deliberately using a poisonous toadstool, mushroom or whatever in a meal. This has got to be in the back of your mind, surely, when you're teaching this.
Well, I've heard an instance of I won't say which one, but like there's a fruit and veg supplier in London who came very close to doing exactly that. Somebody had sent in a box of mixed mushrooms, and it just happened that the head guy happened to come down into the pack room at that time and looked at this box of mushrooms, and there was a deadly poisonous mushroom called a destroying angel in there. So I think it's only a matter of time before something dreadful like that happens, because it doesn't have all the same checks and balances and so on. In Finland, for example, they've got a thing where you have to have a license to sell particular mushrooms, and I think, much as, you know, regulation is tiresome, I think in terms of the level of risk that's there, I think sooner or later we're going to have to probably...
At the end of the day, surely your book is about trying to tool people up with the equipment they need to know that what they're eating is safe.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of emphasis. When you're teaching foraging, I always say, like, you've got two jobs. One is to inspire people and the other is to frighten people. Because if people aren't frightened, people say, oh, I'm a bit worried about picking the wrong thing, you know. And they almost seem to say that as if that disqualifies them. And I say, no. That's the essential starting point. To be frightened that you're going to eat the wrong thing, you'd be mad not to be, because... But having said that, you'd have to qualify that by saying, look, the vast majority of things are edible. There's only a few poisonous mushrooms, there's only a few poisonous plants. But like, it's like playing Russian roulette with slightly better odds, basically. And so, yeah, so you have to start from that vantage point of knowing that there's things that you can't eat, so that you only eat what you know you can eat. And that takes a bit of work, you know. But it's not as daunting as it might sound, because if you learn things one plant or one mushroom at a time... So I always start people out with nettles. Because, you know, you can't misidentify a nettle. If it doesn't sting you, it's not a nettle. There you go. So start with something that's obvious. A dandelion. There's nothing with a dandelion-like flower. So a dandelion flower has a hollow stem that bleeds this kind of milk. It's only got one flower on it. There's lots of things that look similar, none of which are poisonous, by the way. But, like, if you want to be absolutely sure, only pick the dandelion when it's flowering, and you can't mistake it for anything else. And there's another one called plantain, which has parallel veins on its leaves.
So you're talking about starting off with things that are really easy to identify and absolutely clear.
When people come on my courses, I always, this is something I've come to after lots of years. You know, I used to go out and show people 30 plants and not realize that I haven't actually helped them very much, because no one's going to retain that much information. And you don't give them that confidence that they're going to go home and be able to identify and use something without worries or concerns about misidentifying. So now I start with the most easily identified, the most easily remembered plants with something that you can easily remember, and then hopefully people will go home and say, oh, there's that one, and it's definitely got the lions, it definitely stings you, or it's definitely got that dandelion flower. And if they just get started, it then becomes... It's habit forming, that you pick a little bit of this for your salad, or a little bit of this for greens, or you make a tea with that one. And that's the whole point. It's just to form some habits. And then, having learnt two or three, you just start to add one more. And before you know it, you've got a repertoire, you know.
Almost as obsessed as you are.
Almost as obsessed as I am, yeah.
I mean, I think most listeners in the back of their mind will be thinking, hang on, we've got a cost of living crisis going on. I'd quite like to be able to supplement something in my kitchen.
I'd definitely start with nettles, because, you know, you've got greens there, you've got something you can make a soup out of, and you've got something that is super delicious and got that meaty umami flavour, which, you know, a lot of the whole drive towards veganism, I think we've got to remember, let's keep those beautiful flavours that we're so familiar with, and umami is the one when it comes to meat and cheese and so on. So yeah, nettles for all of those reasons, and also you can dry them and make a tea. So yeah, and if people want to hear more about these kind of thoughts, I've got a podcast. It's called The World Wild Podcast. You can just look that up and find it on all the usual providers.
Okay, and just remind us of the title of your book and where to get it.
Yeah, well, the book is The Forager Handbook, and yeah, you can just get that from all good booksellers and online and wherever you buy books.
Okay, Miles. Cost?
Oh, it's £32. I mean, it's a proper big book. It's got lots of words in it, not okay, lots of information.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks.
Just in time. Okay, nice one. Thanks, Miles.